thanks very much. Okay, so I'm gonna talk about stuff I've done in the last few years in collaboration with Philippe, and he will talk about this again, I guess, at the end of this meeting at the conference. And after the introduction of David Kaplan to his talk, I had very mixed feelings. On one hand, I felt very relieved because he clearly encouraged dirty thinking and showing of dirty laundry. No, it's irresponsible thinking. Showing of dirty laundry, etc. So, okay, that relieves me. On the other hand, it became clear to me that we're probably pursuing. But it also became clear we were probably completely on the wrong strategy. He demonstrated how to generate 100 ideas, and then you weed out the 99 wrong ones of them until you have a solution. And what Philippe and I are doing is completely orthogonal. We generated one idea, and now it seems to take 99 years until we have one. So we are still very much towards. And I'll very briefly rush through the setup. That has mostly been given by Maria Paolo last week, and I'll then show mostly numerical results, and I want to encourage discussion and thinking about what they mean and imply. So we're mostly concerned with the phase structure of QCD, and phase structure again is maybe too big a word. So all these new methods for evading the sign problem and simulating anyhow, they work more or less controllably well in the regime where the quark mass chemical potential divided by T is smaller than one. And that means they work within a sector here in this phase diagram. It's a question of if nature is kind enough to have this critical endpoint, which of course is a function of the parameters of the theory, whether that happens to be sitting in this accessible sector or not. So I have nothing to say about these fascinating things over there. And also I will not discuss equation of state and thermodynamic functions, which are of course phenomenologically interesting. But the evidence so far is that the mu effects on the equation of state are very weak, and we'll understand hopefully during the talk why. So I'll just try to hunt down this phase structure in the small mu over T region. Okay, and also what we're trying to do is to determine the parametric dependence of this phase structure. So we want to see how it varies with the quark masses, for example. So it's good to start at zero chemical potential and see what the current situation is. And in fact, even that situation is not very rosy, to be quite honest with you. So here is the phase diagram in the zero chemical potential plane. This is the strange quark mass and the UND quark masses. The three flavor theory lives on this diagonal, and three flavor always means three degenerate flavors in this talk. Otherwise, I shall call it 2+1. So qualitatively, we are pretty certain, and also numerically, these two corners are more or less under control. There is evidence for first order phase transitions. But where exactly these second order boundary lines are running, that is still under investigation. And in particular on this one, which is of course the interesting one, we only know really one point that has been studied with some system, and that's the one here on the diagonal. And the thing that we know now is that this line here is belongs to the universality class of the 3D Ising model. This you can really establish nicely numerically. That has been done by Bielefeld, and I'll show later that we can confirm this. And that is a stable result because this is infrared physics, so this is very stable under cutoff effects. However, the location of this line, that if you take an ordinary unimproved staggered action, it turns out to be at a critical pion mass of about 300 MeV, and this is very cutoff dependent. So recently people have tried to do simulations with improved actions and see where this line is sitting with improved actions, and the indication is that you vary this point by a factor of 4, and it's moving towards smaller quark masses just to make life even more difficult. Okay, so the situation is for this line, basically what we know is we know this line is 3D Ising. We know its location on this diagonal here, but only for one lattice spacing and for one time of action. So even this story is far from being finished. Okay, and towards the end of the talk, I'll come back to this question. Just keep in mind that there are huge cutoff effects. Okay, now at finite density, what happens is we get a third axis, and this is the Karlsruhe of the phase diagram. So then this critical line here, which separates the first order and the crossover regions, of course, becomes a surface. And now the task is to map out this surface, and then the physical QCD with the parameters of nature will be sitting somewhere here, and the critical point will be where this line intersects that critical surface. Okay. Now, in various talks, it has been discussed there are more or less 3 or 4 or 5, depending on how you relate them or distinguish them, methods around, that all of them evade the sign problem rather than solve it. Okay, this is also important to bear in mind. And all of them need U over T to be reasonably small, and it's a big debate where the details, what the details are and where they break down, but I think this is the safe statement. And the interesting thing is that they, even though they have all problems when they exceed this range of validity, the systematic errors are quite different. So they need U over T small for different reasons. And so it's therefore quite good, since none of them is rigorous, to pursue parallel avenues and then really compare and trust where things agree. And of course, Philippe and I have been doing imaginary mu, followed by analytic continuation. And I just want to point out two differences and, in our opinion, advantages that this method offers compared to the multidimensional reweighting and the Taylor expansion. So one benefit is that, of course, there is no sign problem. So numerically, this is much cheaper. It's just simply numerically the cheapest method that's around, and the simulation is as difficult or as easy as an ordinary zero chemical potential simulation. Secondly, even though we need a Taylor expansion as well in order to analytically continue, our simulation results are complete. There is no, so the imaginary mu simulation results are the full theory, there is no approximation. And that means you get some handle on the systematic error, because you can see whether this fits a finite truncated polynomial or not. And so you have a feeling, whereas in this Taylor expansion, you have to really compute the coefficients one by one in different simulations. So this is a difference in principle. Then there are also there is another aspect which is important in assessing the statistical errors, and this is that this is the only approach where you really generate ensembles where you vary two parameters, namely mu and t. In these approaches both, the ensemble is always a zero chemical potential one, which is then either reweighted or expanded around, but your numerics is all generated from a zero chemical potential ensemble, okay? And that means that all the statistical errors, once you vary parameters, are correlated, whereas in this case, you get really uncorrelated results. So this is just a numerical aspect. Okay, let me briefly remind you of some basic properties which are quite interesting and help you learn a lot, even for real mu, without even doing a simulation. So Maria has more or less explained this, so I'll just briefly summarize. If you put an exact, a complex chemical potential, there is one extra symmetry, which is important. So these are two exact symmetries of QCD at finite density. One is this reflection symmetry, if you flip mu to minus mu, which is essentially the same as CP conservation. And the other one, which is not there at purely real chemical potential, is this periodicity in the imaginary direction, which was proved by Robertian and Weiss. And the period is interestingly 2 pi over the number of colors rather than 2 pi. And this Maria has already shown. So if you look at the complex chemical potential plane, then you get at intervals which are exactly known because of these symmetries, you get set 3 transitions in which the theory is basically mirror image. The only observable that's sensitive to the different size is the phase of the Polyakov loop, which is trivial here, and here it's non-trivial, etc. And after 3, you of course cycle through. Okay, now if we want to these authors have conjectured that this transition is first of all for high temperatures and it's a crossover for low temperatures. And I won't go into those details, but we have actually checked this by simulations, and this is confirmed. So this means if I want to take the infinite volume limit, the thermodynamic limit, and I want to learn something for the real mu axis by doing simulations on the imaginary mu axis, I have to stay within this quadrant. This is the safe statement. Okay, and then Maria has explained that under certain circumstances, if you restrict yourself to a branch of metastability or something, you can even extend and then you provide extra information, which might be useful. But the safe statement is if we confine ourselves to this arc, then we should be fine as long as there are no further singularities in this arc. Okay, what does the phase diagram in the imaginary T mu plane look like? This is what it looks like. This is this Robert-Schweitzer set 3 transition here, where the Polyakov loop changes sign, and because of these symmetries and the evenness, the phase diagram is completely mirror symmetric around this line. So here we have a crossover. This is a first order transition, and this endpoint here is consistent with icing, as you would expect. And then, of course, the whole thing is continued periodically. So really, we only get useful information from this first sector. And then the deconfinement line, or the chiral symmetry breaking line, or whatever you want to call it, it's of course neither for finite quark masses, runs upwards here in this case because of we're at imaginary mu. And you can also study how the endpoint moves as a function of parameters, and that will vary from anywhere from the axis until all the way out there. And this is what we set out to do. And if you convert this interval to physical units, then it translates into a baryon chemical potential, which is up to 600 MeV. So this is the range of applicability. And outside, then we get into muddy waters. And the strategy then is simulate an observable on this axis. That's the full result, no approximation. And then see how well is this described by a truncated tail series, after which, of course, analytic continuation is trivial. So now the question is, for analytic continuation, I need analyticity. So how can I do a phase transition? And here we use the following strategy. So on the lattice, you locate the pseudo-critical temperature by the peak of a susceptibility. You just look for the maximum of the fluctuations. So this is a susceptibility of any operator, plaquette or chiral condensate or Polyakov loop. And we typically look at all of them and compare that they're consistent, etc. And the key observation is that, of course, on the lattice, and this is not specific to chemical potential, this is true for any phase transition, on a finite volume, there are no phase transitions. Okay, everything is pseudo-critical. In all cases, everything is finite and analytic. And phase transitions are really extracted on the lattice by finite volume scaling analysis. You have to look how these things approach singularities, which of course they never do for a finite volume, okay? So as long as I'm on a finite volume, I know that my susceptibility, it's not a delta function, it's a finite peak. And that's an analytic function. And beta critical is defined by this peak. That's an implicit definition of this critical coupling as a function of mu, through a constraint on this function of the susceptibility. And then you can invoke the implicit function theorem, which will tell you that this implicitly defined function beta critical has as many continuous derivatives as the model function chi. And that means on my finite volume, this beta critical, this pseudo critical line, is an analytic function of chemical potential. So I can write it in this form, and I know it's only even powers because of the symmetries of the theory. So the strategy is at imaginary mu, look at this phase transition in the imaginary direction. Find this function, try to fit it as well as you can, and then continue. Okay, the next question is what do we expect physically for this, if we translate these to physical units? And this is quite interesting because you actually get a feeling for the size of the effects that are going to follow. So what we are claiming and then demonstrating is that the natural expansion parameter is actually not mu over t, but it's mu over pi t. Of course, you can expand in anything you want, but an expansion, a Taylor expansion, is useful if your coefficients are of order one, because then you can have a feeling, then things depend on the size of your expansion parameter, whether it's small or big. Now, why is that? One reason is there is a perturbative argument, which is that thermal perturbation theory goes the modes are the Matsubara modes, the Matsubara frequencies in thermal field theory, and those come in multiples of pi t. And there is also a non-perturbative argument by going back to this to the definition of this theory. We have seen that imaginary chemical potential is equivalent of a shift in the Matsubara frequencies by pi t or multiples thereof. And this is a non-perturbative argument. Okay, so pi t are the natural modes in this finite temperature field theory. So if I expand for example, the critical temperature in physical units, and I look at its change compared to the zero chemical potential situation, then this one here should be even powers of mu over pi t, and I would expect that then the coefficients are of order one. Okay, now numerical results.
Some signs.
I put some signs, yeah, but of course they
didn't. I mean, the older one is assumed to be positive. The red thing is positive. That's what you
put. Yes. But yeah. But of course that comes out. I mean, you don't have to.
You don't have a reason for that a priori, or you do.
Do we have? do we have? Yeah, I think we do have. I mean, you expect. You expect this round to go down.
I mean, what I'm after is that something in the secondary will be. I don't know, something about the susceptibility being positive than it was a sign. It's not.
That's the thing.
Yes.
And the serve, so the mu to the fourth one.
That for that, I wouldn't have a.
Well, it depends, in fact, if the critical line is really, I mean, we find it to be well defined by a polynomial, but it might well be that other parameterizations are more adequate. And so the sign of the fourth coefficient would depend on the kind of parameterization which is.
Parameterization,
but the critical line itself, for instance, in Hamilton resonance test model, the critical line would be described by hyperbolic cosine of mu over t for example.
You mean the fact that you took the definition of the critical line from a finite temperature P, for finite volume P, is that very important?
No, as always, okay, I don't want to stop, I'll just continue, we can discuss later, but as always, just explain.
This is informal.
As always.
No, but you can have a function which still is altered at signs, right? You can still decrease, everything's fine.
Yeah, I'm just asking.
You don't know the fourth.
I was just motivated because usually you write plus of the one plus of the one, and the sign is in the order one. I can say if you wrote one minus and one plus, I said maybe there's a message.
The message with the leading sign was the impression is because I know that the line has to have gone.
I see.
But that's only the leading behavior.
I see. So there was a question in the first term, yes. And the others were reverting to the normal.
Exactly. And of course, one can discuss how qualified that prejudice is, but yeah. But of course, you can measure this, so you don't need to stick it in. Okay, so let me now do the numerics here. So what I'm going to show is mostly the three flavor results, i.e. three degenerate flavors. And while we're at it, I also want to do a quark mass expansion. And this MC of zero chemical potential, I guess, I don't know if you remember, but this is an important thing which will pop up again, so I'll remind you of it. That is simply the quark mass at this point, the critical value of the quark mass. Okay, this is this, and this is what we expand around. So we have this double. Sorry, why? Because in the end, we are interested in pursuing this critical line away from that point. And so firstly,
we're
simulating at various masses. Yeah, but this allows us to get a mass dependence and expression.
Yeah, I just don't understand why expand around that point.
You want to,
why that point, not around m equals zero?
No. Okay. So m equals zero is a bad point because m equals zero, then you don't have analyticity anymore. Because then funny things are happening if you expand around m equals zero. That's my theory is not guaranteed to be analytic if I expand around a massless mode.
In a finite volume, there's something
about this.
I think
right.
I
not in a finite
volume. No, all you analytics is
yeah.
Finite.
That's true. But if I expand around m equals zero, plus it's a simulation question. Of course, MC of zero is bigger than zero, and you want to be. I mean, that's where you can simulate and not close to zero. So. And it's a special point, which we're interested in also. And I'm looking at the neighborhood of that.
We're interested in small mu, so we're interested in the curvature of this red surface.
Yes.
That maybe the curvature of
right. This thing. So we are interested in this region here, in the neighborhood of this point, because we want to know how this critical lines is running. So this is a. And then we're closest to where the action is. Here we go. All right, so this is what we do, and this is now the results. And this critical coupling you can actually determine quite accurately. So here I have thrown all. I mean, this is a whole range of masses, and they're all thrown into the same plot by shifting them to this point. And you can see a small finite volume effect here on the smallest 8-cubed spatial lattice, and then 10 and 12 are basically what determine this fit, and you get an excellent fit, which is rather accurate. And you can also see an ever so slight curvature on this line, which is plotted against mu squared, so we are sensitive to the mu to the fourth term. But if you convert the numbers to physical units, this is the result, and you can easily see that even on the sort of rightmost end of this boundary, this term has very little effect. So you get a very good description by even the leading term. Okay, so this is where the critical temperature stands in this free flavor theory, and so the point is, of course, these data points are without approximation. Okay, and you can then really try how different fits here differ, and you can see whether you're in control or not. Then you can look at the flavor dependence. We have done a two flavor and a three flavor simulation. Maria and Massimo Delia have done the four flavor simulation. So this is all done at imaginary chemical potential. So this is almost apples with apples, except that this blue curve is much more accurate than the other two because it was done much later and we were really going for the next two leading term. Then. There is another interesting observation because of this, because of pi t being the expansion parameter. You can actually argue that if you take the strange quark mass away from its physical value to say disturb it so that it has the same value as the light quark masses, then this difference between these two values is actually small compared to pi tc, so that it makes some sense to compare the 2 plus 1 flavor theory that Fodor and Katz have studied with the three flip theory. So this is the light quark masses here have the same masses, and the strange quark mass is different evidently between the two, but you can see that our line here lies completely on top of theirs. That's quite remarkable. On one hand, on the other hand, in the units I have chosen to plot, of course you see that this critical temperature changes only by a few percent, okay? And this is all the way out to mu baryon of something like 500 or 600 MeV. So these things are very slowly varying, and of course that's the reason why things work.
Is that mu baryon different from the mu in the Taylor expansion?
Yeah, so we always, the thing we work with is the quark mu, which is 1/3 of mu baryon. So when there is no index, it's always quark, and otherwise I put mu b. All right, so far things look pretty good. And also people have done more comparisons at really identical parameter values. So Maria and Massimo have looked at, in the fourth label theory, they compared the Fodor-Katz reweighting with imaginary chemical potential. This is again the critical coupling, now as a function of mu, and our set three transition sort of being careful zone is roughly here. So you can see to the left of it, there is perfectly Riemann. And then the Bielefeld-Swansea collaboration has done its Taylor-expanded simulation around mu equals zero in both directions, the real and the imaginary direction. And again, the two agree. But this plot also illustrates what I've said earlier. All the error bars here, of course, are just reweighted away from zero, so there is no statistical jumping around here. So this is just a numerical observation.
Okay, and just would like to comment, today there is a paper by
yes.
a collaborator on the web, and they confirm actually that it's for flavor. They confirm our results down to up to mu equals 0.5, so the ones with the smaller critical, with the
lower this one here, you mean?
Yes.
I see.
Yeah,
okay.
Yes.
So this was brand new today on the web. I haven't read the full thing yet. They do imaginary chemical potential, but they add.
Read last month.
Yeah. Here you have no excuse. thank you for that one. So they add a new parameter to the theory. In the end, they have, of course, to go to the same points as we do, but what they claim is that the new parameter permits them to simulate in regions and infer the functional dependence, which allows them to extrapolate. And they claim they can do larger mu and smaller t, and that's, of course, quite interesting. Also,
the same mu that we did, they arrived at 0.5, yes. 0.5 is
doable. Well, I mean, these data points are fine. Right, it's all within errors. So, another thing I want to mention is that people also have done this was a question I think earlier last week, a comparison to SU2, where of course you can do the full simulation, and so they've checked the imaginary and the real simulations, and that's also fine. So
the
far,
question is whether this tells you anything about SU3.
Yeah. I mean, no, of course not. Of course not. But you're checking this method. You're checking the method.
Not really. Yeah, no, I don't think so. You're not checking it for SU, whether it would work in SU3. Of course, they check that it works in SU2, but that's a completely different case. So.
Everybody
no, except for the face. I mean,
because what you mean by checking that you get correctly the coefficients, or checking whether knowing the coefficients you can say something.
Exactly.
Two stages. So the first part, I think, is check whether that carries information about the SU3 substitute there.
That is very
important. So you guys agree, just for different sakes.
Okay, so this is the good part. And now we get to the dirty laundry part. So the critical endpoint and its quark mass dependence is, of course, much more difficult, and this is now the interesting part. So I also discussed this first in this three-flavor theory, where we have actually finished the computation and we know that phase diagram now. So that's a three-dimensional phase diagram. You have temperature, chemical potential, and the quark mass. And what I've shown you was this pseudo-critical temperature, which is a function of mu and m. I've given you this Taylor expansion of that. But I haven't, I mean, as I was saying, this is all pseudo-critical, and I haven't told you where was first order, where was second order, where was crossover, and so on. So this pseudo-critical surface is split by a line of critical points, which I call T star here. And that line separates the first order from the crossover line, and that's, of course, the line we're interested in. So how does this, you can smoothly connect these real mu and imaginary mu regimes by, if we take our T mu diagram, but instead we now take T mu squared. And then again, let's look at this, at the phase transition line here. And at the critical quark mass value, at zero chemical potential, that's exactly the quark mass value where this line reaches all the way to the temperature axis. Okay, and then the critical point is on the temperature axis. Now, if I make the quark mass slightly larger, then our prejudice is that this critical point wanders into the finite mu regime. This is the case we're interested in. But of course, I can also make the quark mass smaller, in which case on axis I have a first order transition, but this critical endpoint wanders into the imaginary direction. So the critical endpoint upon variation of the quark mass traces out this fit line here, which is this T star of mu. Okay, and this is, of course, the view. If you plot this in the T mu plane, I can also project this critical surface onto the M mu plane, and then I get a picture like this. Here is my critical quark mass. Now I do slight perturbations of mu around this. And what the slope here of this line gives me is precisely, again, in this 3D phase diagram, the slope in this diagram is precisely how much this surface leans towards the three-flavor diagonal here. So that's the slope. And if I know that slope, then I know, then I can compute for a given quark mass, I can compute the critical mu. So what would you expect? According to the arguments that I made earlier, you can do the same expansion. So we expand the critical quark mass around its zero chemical potential value, and it should behave just the same way as everything else behaves. The pressure also has coefficients of order one, so we expect, again, coefficient of order one here, okay? And if, furthermore, this line is approximated to a good degree by the leading order term, as all the other quantities looked at so far were, then you can even derive a limit on this slope, because this critical line here separating first order from crossover cannot hit the chiral limit axis, because you know that always in the chiral limit you must have a true first order phase transition. So that also provides a bound on this slope. That, of course, is only true if the leading term is really dominant.
Okay, a question. How do I know this is the second order phase transition on the one that is straight up at minus 1.9? Is
it this thing here?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is the set three transition.
But it's first order in the other thing, right?
Yeah, but the temperature is always fixed to be the critical temperature of the deconfinement line, and that always ends up in this end point until it joins it, in which case it becomes first order, and this is this bit. Okay, so now a comment on the calculation of this. The way you compute this is you use the fact that this critical line is 3D Ising, and that there is this observable which Don Sinclair discussed to some length, which is the Binder cumulant, that's the fluctuations of the chiral condensate, or its fourth and second moments, and that assumes a universal value in the infinite volume limit, and it's larger than this or smaller than this in a crossover and first order regime. So this is how you know where you are. However, this thing is an enormously difficult thing to calculate, also at zero chemical potential, And just to illustrate a little bit about this, I give two distributions here of the plaquette. These are histograms. One is sort of in the deepest first order regime that we have looked at, and the other is in the deepest crossover regime that we have looked at. And what you see here is a classic first order signal, a two-peak distribution, and as you make the volume bigger, the peaks grow, and the tunneling becomes more suppressed. This is what you expect. The shocking thing is that the crossover also looks like two-peak on these volumes, okay? And this is what makes things so difficult. And of course, it behaves the correct way. This thing comes up, and eventually, this thing should be just a Gaussian. But what you see is that on physical volumes, I mean, there is just a gradual difference. And, sorry?
Isn't the middle going up in one case and going down in the other?
Yeah, exactly. But what I'm saying is you have to if you want to quantify this, you have to be very careful because it's a fine distinction. And this quantity, also the statistical error of this thing, is unfortunately not shrinking with the number of measurements you make, but with the number of tunnelings between the two phases. And those happen there. You want a large volume for these features to be distinct, but then if you have a large volume, you suppress tunneling, and so it's really difficult. Okay, so here is a plot which is similar to the one that Don Sinclair was showing. This is this Binder equivalent against some linear combination of quark masses and chemical potentials. And so this is again telling quite a lot just qualitatively. You can see there is huge scatter, even though we have accumulated many, many trajectories. And Don was a bit worried about the wrong tendency of the slope of this thing in his case, but he had 3 points. And you can see if you take, you know, any selection of 3 points of this, you can get any slope you want, okay? And then again, also in these reweighted approaches, you would just have a nicely straight lines with parallel error bars. And then, of course, the whole thing follows the fluctuation of the one ensemble that you have looked at. And so, in other words, it's tremendously difficult to really extract a conclusive result from this thing. So these are 17, I believe, data points on one volume. And we have done a three-parameter fit. What we determine is, so we expand around this critical point at zero chemical potential. And so this is a fit parameter, this is a fit parameter, and this is a fit parameter. So this is a cross-check. This is known in the literature. We are in complete agreement with Columbia and Bielefeld on this one. And then these two are the new piece of information, and they, by the chain rule, they give you precisely this coefficient that we're after. And you can see, even though there was a lot of labor and a lot of statistics, we have essentially, I mean, you're just about to have a signal, okay? This is essentially within two sigma, this is consistent with zero. But there is a very crucial message here, and this is that this thing is indeed, again, of order one, as expected. And if anything, it's small. And this has profound consequences, because this means this is a small number, okay, mu over pi t. So you have very little variation of the critical quark mass with mu, or if you turn it around, if you plot mu versus m in this phase diagram, the conclusion is that this slope on the diagonal here is, I mean, this surface comes out almost perpendicular, okay? And again, there is nothing to be terribly surprised about. This is just the same as it was for the critical temperature, which came out almost horizontally. So it's behaving normally, but it's bad news, because what that means is if you now go to the physical point, if that physical point is far away from the line, then the critical chemical potential will be at a rather large value. Okay, and you have to be very close to the surface in order to have a small critical chemical potential. So even though we are not terribly accurate, and it's difficult to see how one could get this much more accurate, you learn quite a bit about the quantitative behavior. Now, Bielefeld has also tried to do a similar calculation. They have done this with improved actions, And
last one, this mu is the bionic or the quark?
This is the quark again. Yeah. And they get a coefficient here which is several orders of magnitude larger than ours. That's the bad news. And we are convinced that this cannot be right because it also violates this bound that we have derived. So you should, if that is true, you need a large subleading term, which we don't see. But the good news is this also is only 2 sigma away from zero. So so it just tells you, it just tells you, I mean, this is
completely consistent.
This is, yeah. This is very long.
Yeah. Everything.
Okay, so then you can do a couple of checks. So we have taken our result and we have done some finite size scaling. So we have taken this coefficient mu in front of this linear combination that we figured in our bin accumulant and done that for different volumes. This is a point borrowed from Bielefeld for the same action. And you can fit this finite volume scaling, and this is the result. And you see it is wonderfully consistent with the Ising case. So even though the volumes are kind of smallish, you get the correct finite volume scaling. Then I can make a further check, and I can stick this, I can fix the Ising exponent, and I can use this to plot all the different volumes. So I now plot all these Binder cumulants, all these different volumes in one plot. Okay, and now I have this new here is fixed, that's not a free parameter anymore. So now I have again my 3 fit parameters, but I have now 35 points. And you see they are scattered, and you see there is no, I mean, there is no strong indication for mu to the fourth in this. So things are consistent. So what does this teach us about, and just to point this out once more, I mean, we have now the three flavor theory is in this leading approximation. It's if you know which quark mass you want, you can calculate what the critical, where the critical point is. What does this teach us for the real world? Well, that's what I just said. Can one expect the critical point to be at a small chemical potential? If I take, for example, this Fodor-Katz value of 100 MeV for mu critical and translate this to the three flavor theory, then it means that this ratio has to be somewhere between 1 and 1.05. Otherwise, the critical point would be way out. Okay, and that means, that's what I just tried to explain, this the physical point has to be very close to the critical line in this quark mass phase diagram, and that means you have to fine-tune the quark masses, or they have to be fine-tuned to about a few percent. And that means you have even to worry, in the real world, you might have to worry about the difference between the U and the V quark mass in the end, if you want an accurate prediction. Okay, the last few minutes I want to spend on the 2+1 flavor case. This is what we've been trying to do for the last half year or so. So now I have an extra parameter. Now I have 2 quark masses to vary. And now the strategy is we do a 2-step procedure. So first we take 0 chemical potential and we now have to find this critical line because this is presumably not a good expansion point anymore if we want to go further out there. And so the first stage was to measure this this line here. And then, of course, in the second step, you will have to repeat the whole thing and see how that varies with chemical potential. But that's the future. This is the result that we have so far. So now these the strange and the UND axis are scaled slightly differently. The green line here gives you the 3-flavor diagonal. So far, I've been talking about this one point. And we have now produced a whole series of critical points here in this plane. And this is also very interesting because some of our more courageous colleagues sometimes like to extrapolate linearly from this diagonal point to the physical point, and you can see that this clearly doesn't work. If you do that, you end up here. That's the first lesson. And then there is an interesting sort of off-spin. Something that's still debated is what is the nature of the phase transition here on the boundary of the box. Universality arguments tell you that if it's second order, then it's in the O4 universality class. And if that is the case, then you get a tree critical point here at some point, because you're going to first order down here. And tree critical dynamics is mean field. So you also, in this case, you also know how this icing line here enters the tree critical point. That's with light point mass to the power 2/5. And so if we assume that to be the case, we can make a fit. And that just fits nicely our data. And this fit here, the blue line, assumes that essentially in the chiral limit, you have a reflection symmetry about the strange quark mass. So the leading behavior down here should be a quadratic one. So this is the two fits that we use, and both of them work quite nicely, and you know, you just have to interpolate between them. So this is quite nice, and also it gives you a prediction for this tree critical point. And as I've emphasized in the beginning, of course, it's completely useless because these lines will move all over the place if you vary the lattice spacing. So in physical units, it's not still not quite clear where this is. One last comment to the finite mu stuff. These blue crosses here are where Fodor and Katz were simulating. And interestingly, their latest simulation, which gave the prediction for the physical quark masses, is right next to our critical line and on the correct side of it. So this is at least qualitatively consistent with having a relatively small critical chemical potential. So that goes together with our small slope.
That would then mean for identical the same lattice spacing?
Yes, which is true.
We and the other one is off because the lattice spacing is...
No, this is, you see, this is different quark masses. This is much heavier quark masses. Yeah. But also the same lattice spacing.
Okay.
But that, we would expect, must have a way higher critical chemical potential because this surface goes up rather perpendicularly.
And this is what they found?
Yes. Okay, and that's essentially it. So now we have to, one thing that would be interesting if we could discuss with you would be if there are opinions on this O4 business, because that seems to be somewhat controversial, and we're not quite sure what how strong a statement we should make about this. And then, of course, the future will be a repetition of this calculation, now for finite mu. And of course, at the end of the day, we'll have a prediction for this thing, and it will have 50% error at best, and things are going to be very difficult in the future. Also, if you consider this sensitivity, remember you have to do a continuum limit, okay? And then these lines move; the physical point stays fixed, and you have to get these things really accurate. Okay, so the summary is simulations are possible at small mu over t. We've taken here the sort of the conservative approach. The location of the transition line or the pseudo-critical surface is consistent in all attempts that are on the market. So that looks very good, but that's the easy part. And still, one can learn something. This critical line is very flat. It has a small quark mass dependence, and you can understand that in terms of the thermodynamics and Matsubara frequencies and so on. And then the critical endpoint, I think, is going to be a real problem, not only because of course the whole sign problem business, but because it's difficult to measure it, and because it's extremely sensitive to the quark mass. So if you want a critical point below, say, 400 MeV baryon, that would be now, then you have to have very finely tuned quark masses. And if you want to compute it, you need to know the quark masses in physical units to percent accuracy, essentially. So it's going to take 99 years to finish this. Thank you.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I thought that when you go to the tricritical point, then from the universal behavior there, you can predict what the quagmire's dependence would be in the neighborhood of the triplet.
Exactly.
So you can sort of, from that you can see whether or not there's strong dependencies. That's what you mean?
We have employed that. So this purple line here uses precisely this. So the prediction is that this is that print here. It should go with the Pope master
so
two feet,
right,
and we use this.
Okay,
so we fit the coefficient of it, that's all. But that's precisely what we use. And it's consistent, but of course, you know, this thing could also go all the way up without hitting the axis. I mean, that's difficult to differentiate, but that's what we use.
Yeah.
In the latest build platform collaboration paper, they say they don't see any critical point up to, I don't know, 0.8 TC or something like that. And can you understand, I mean, maybe they have different data spacing, I don't know. Can you understand where the coarseness is on this?
So the latest is, I believe, the lattice spacing is the same, I believe it's also, it's not the same action.
Right?
Yeah. So you can, and that's the problem, because these quark masses renormalize strongly, I mean, by factors of anything between 2 and 4. And this is what I was saying, I mean, that's the pity, you know, you've done a lot of work now, and but if you do, if you do this, you have to extrapolate it to continue, and the line will move strongly. So
in other words, you don't like their mass is too big so that the thing moved away by the norms.
But so the Fodor-Katz simulations are done with the same action, same lattice spacing, so this is a meaningful comparison.
And then if you compare the mass that Don has used for isospin, do you know where it is?
Yes, they took a mass which was just outside, that was here. It was close, but on the crossover side of the phase transition. And they also use the same action and the same lattice spacing. So again, this is a meaningful comparison.
Anybody knows this all for story was to take away discussing it? I don't know. Completely. So, no. Or rather, let's say. Oh, I forgot to say.